At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The size of the country's biggest beef recall in history is stunning by any standard. 143 million pounds of raw and frozen beef. And the way meat is processed and mixed these days, that amount could end up being far larger. It's a huge blow to the company that was pressured to initiate the voluntary recall, and the beef industry is bracing for a hit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal on this President's Day, the 18th of February. Glad you could join us. That 143 million pounds of beef being recalled was produced by a California meatpacker over the past couple of years. The trouble came to light when food safety inspectors were tipped off by an undercover video. It showed workers at the Hallmark meatpacking plant using electric prods and forklifts to get cattle too weak to stand on their own into slaughter. As Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington, the entire beef industry is bracing now for a drop in demand.
Officials say they haven't found any contaminated beef and call the risk of illness remote. But the slaughter of cows unable to stand violates food safety rules, and Agriculture Department inspectors found evidence Hallmark has been doing that for 2 years. That's why the recall is so huge. But officials say most of Hallmark's beef was consumed long ago. 37 million pounds of Hallmark's beef went to the school lunch program, so inspectors are looking for some portion that could still be found in school freezers. A couple of states have pulled meat from their school lunch menus in response. Janet Riley with the American Meat Institute says demand for their product usually drops temporarily after recalls, but not always.
We've been really astonished by how some of the most high-profile situations actually resulted in increased consumer confidence, because sometimes high-profile issues give us an opportunity to talk about what we do, and that has actually encouraged consumers.
Since no contaminated beef has turned up, the industry is hoping the hit won't be a big one. Harry Balzer is vice president of the NPD consumer marketing firm that tracks consumer eating trends. Over the past 6 years, they've watched the threats from mad cow disease to E. coli and salmonella.
But the amazing thing about this, while the concerns will rise, you don't see much in the change of long-term shifts in consumption. But more important, you don't see a long-term shift in the change in our attitude about the safety of the food supply. It just is the issue of the moment. And this happens to be the one.
Balzer says even in the worst cases of contaminated food, consumers change what they buy for as long as a year. But after that, they'll be back to buying the same food they always have. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There are all kinds of reports today that Toshiba is set to raise the white flag in the high-definition video war. The company says it could announce a decision as soon as tomorrow on whether it'll stop making HD DVD players. But a lot of people aren't waiting. Walmart dumped the format at the end of last week. And Percy Greenberg, who manages a video store for a small chain called TLA Video in Pennsylvania, has been expecting this.
To be honest, we actually got a memo from our main office that we were no longer going to carry HD and that we should sell off everything we have. But ours were still kind of renting, and so we decided to keep them for rental as long as, you know, they were still renting.
Until today, that is. She just put discount sales stickers on every HD DVD that's left. It was just over a year ago at the big consumer electronics show that Mark Knox, a spokesman for Toshiba, was promising that they'd stand by the format in the battle with Sony's Blu-ray system.
I will go out on a limb and make a prediction that neither myself or my brother spokespeople on the other side of the fence are going to disappear in a cloud of pixelated dust because we got fragged by the other guy. We're going to see HD DVD around for a very long time.
Yeah, well, hey, we know a year can be a very long time in the life cycle of some of those gadgets. Get them while they're hot at today's big sales. This is, after all, President's Day, so we wondered just where this day ranks for the world of retail. Marshall Cohen is chief analyst for the research firm NPD Group. He tells us this isn't the big sales day it used to be.
Years ago, it really was one of the few times where the retailers could use this holiday as a time to try to lure customers in for clearance time. But over the last decade, we've seen a lot less retailers to really try to use this card because they got so focused on January and so focused on bringing spring merchandise forward in the month of February that a lot of the retailers pushed their big clearance month ahead of time. So there are just a few businesses that really still play the President's Day card from a commercial standpoint.
When can it be effective for a retailer to use this day?
Well, this really becomes something when you are trying to market as a special. You know, when you look at the auto industry, there, you know, almost every dealer now is talking about President's Day today as being a really great time to buy a car. You know, the deals aren't that much different than what you would find any other month, but they use the name as a lure to try to drive it in, to try to get the excitement built up.
Well, I think we all know, you know, days around Thanksgiving are really big. The Black Friday you've got, or the following Monday, Cyber Monday, really important to retailers. How does this rank compared to that, for example?
Years ago, this would have been in the top 10. Now, it really basically is probably not even in the 10 to 20 number. It's almost has gone from being a very important day to a vacation day. And on vacation, that's not really what's necessarily going to drive traffic into the stores. Some of the industries that have really held on to this, businesses like the mattress business, the auto industry, and in some cases, you'll find some fashion retailers using it when business is tough. They'll roll out the President's Day special. Today, we have some retailers that are actually trying to do that, and that really is a sign that shows me that they're really just having a tougher time clearing some of their older merchandise than they have had, as they would expect.
I wonder, why do certain industries identify with this day?
Well, it really has everything to do with the competition. You don't want somebody in the industry that hasn't left President's Day from a marketing opportunity to be the only one out there doing it, so they're busy and you're not. So the industries tend to compete with each other. The other key here is to recognize when you look at the industries that are really using President's Day, this is merchandise that doesn't really change a lot. A car is a car for the year, in some cases even for two or three. A mattress, it's the same mattress all year round, sometimes even for several years. So those are the industries that rely on these, manufactured holidays to take advantage of it because they really don't have the obsolescence of product at the same degree that some of the other industries have.
How do you think George or Abe would feel about their day being associated with selling a mattress?
Well, when you think about it, these two guys just got short-sighted because they, you know, basically each had their own holiday and now they're sharing one that isn't even on their day. So in the first place, I'm sure they're sitting there saying, hey, first, you took me and now you changed the money on me and now you're going to take my birthdays away and change that. The answer probably is they would look at it much like a lot of things that we've done with holidays and commercialized it and probably sit there and say it wasn't quite the concept that they had in mind from the get-go.
Marshall Cohen is chief analyst for NPD Group. Thanks for joining us and enjoy the holiday.
My pleasure, and same to you.
As soon as we're done here. Hang on to that thought. Wall Street had the day off, but trading was mostly positive overseas. Details when we do the numbers. Next year, we'll mark the 100th anniversary of the introduction of the Lincoln penny. By some estimates, two-thirds of the pennies minted may drop out of circulation almost immediately, probably wedged in with the French fries between the passenger seats in your car. They're about as useful as, well, to coin a phrase, about as useful as a penny in a vending machine. Commentator and international economist Dan Dresner says it's time to make the penny a real collector's item. Here's his address on the subject.
419 years ago, our national mint brought forth on this country a new coin, conceived to honor Abraham Lincoln, dedicated to the proposition that all coins bearing his image would be worth exactly one penny. Now we are engaged in a great spike in the price of zinc and copper, testing whether this nation, frankly, can afford the penny any longer. In 2006, it cost more money to produce a penny than its face value. The U.S. Mint had to issue new regulations designed to prevent the melting down of coins. With inflation on the rise, the penny cannot long endure its diminished status. Today, a single penny can't buy anything. It is altogether fitting and proper that we question whether the penny deserves a final resting place. Perhaps it should go the way of other outdated concepts, like the half-cent coin, which was abolished in 1857. Economists across the political spectrum think this is a promising idea. In a larger sense, however, we cannot determine. We cannot divine. We cannot decide this question. The historians, who have struggled to burnish Abraham Lincoln's legacy with, well, Lincoln-esque properties, have unintentionally consecrated the penny far above our poor power to debate this issue rationally. Public radio listeners will little note, nor long remember what I say here, but you should never forget the massive amount of change jingling in my pocket. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated now to the unfinished work of bettering the country that Lincoln so nobly advanced. We must be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, the preservation of sensible and sound money. Switching Lincoln's iconic image to, say, the nickel, would ensure that the penny would not have died in vain, that change jars across this nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that meaningful coins manufactured by a government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Dan Dresner is a professor at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. A penny for your thoughts? Find us at marketplace.org and click on Contact. Okay, help me out here, because it's my job to create some kind of logical flow for the program, so just go with me on this one, if you will. From pennies with facial hair to the flip side of that coin, pennies thanks to facial hair. In the world of charitable giving, 20-somethings show up in surveys as the least likely age group to donate. So how did one New York City charity get scores of young men to fundraise for kids in the Big Easy? Alex Goldmark got the answer by a whisker.
Call it humiliation for a good cause. That's the secret to Mustaches for Kids, a 7-year-old fundraising group with 11 different chapters, including its largest in New York City. In a trendy Manhattan bar, 25-year-old Nick Levins has mixed feelings about his patchy but respectable mustache.
It finally came in. I was worried for 2 or 3 weeks. It looked like if you were to wet your lip and put dried cocoa powder on it, that brown crust look. Not so attractive. Not so good for the love life.
It's like a quirky walkathon. Levins grows an embarrassing mustache for 4 weeks, then gets his friends and relations to sponsor his mustache with donations. He raised $750 for the Children's Hospital of New Orleans.
This is the first time we've ever actually made money off of mustache growing.
Roger Gorman is the director of development at the hospital, which has received $11,000 from the New York chapter.
It helps us offset a tremendous loss that we've sustained to have somebody out of the blue contact us and say, listen, I'd like to help. I think that's pretty important.
Important because the fundraisers are 20-somethings, a demographic that usually spends what little money it has on itself. So why did nearly 50 young men endure snickering coworkers and itchy upper lips?
Welcome to the Mustaches for Kids Sweetest Stash Competition 2005, New York City.
Because it's fun.
Mitch Goldman is one of the organizers.
Okay, Sweetest Stash Competition is a cross between a beauty pageant, a costume ball, and a police lineup.
In a pleasantly chaotic bar basement, dozens of friends cheer on the growers through a Q&A round, a touch test, and even a beer foam retention round.
Number 12, beer foam retention. He's taking a long sip. You might want to... Oh, he's not taking anything for the sweet bag.
The competition harkens back to the group's founding, when two friends wagered over who could grow the sweetest mustache. Since then, Mustaches for Kids has raised over $130,000 for children's charities. To keep it fun, organizers spend dozens of hours discussing mustache minutia and arranging weekly mustache-related social events.
All this for charity.
In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Coming up, historians who cannot tell a lie come clean.
Everybody thinks they know something about George Washington. Frankly, most of what they know is wrong. You know, myths like the cherry tree and the wooden teeth, of course.
But first, let's do the numbers. The U.S. markets were closed today due to the President's Day holiday. Around the world, most markets ended on a positive note. In the United Kingdom, the benchmark FTSE rose 2.8%. The spotlight there was on bank stocks after the British government moved to nationalize the troubled mortgage lender Northern Rock. Barclays and Lloyds both finished up more than 7%. The entertainment sector also saw a boost. Toshiba's stock jumped on reports it's going to abandon the HD DVD business. That stock finished up almost 7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. By Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Medtronic, celebrating National Heart Month by encouraging women to reduce their risk of heart disease. More at goredforwomen.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The EU hosts its fifth annual Worldwide Security Conference in Brussels. President George Bush visits Ghana as part of his six-day tour of Africa. And on this day in 1878, Thomas Edison got his groove on after receiving a patent for the phonograph. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Can you imagine how much better life might have been for George Washington with just a few whitening strips? When you think about it, some successful innovations are not technological, they're psychological. Someone figures out how to make us want something we didn't know we cared about. A few years back, a survey by the American Academy of Cosmetic Dentistry found that 99% of us believe a smile is an important social asset. The rest of us just frown a lot. Ashley Milne-Tite took a look at why more people have literally been putting their money where their mouth is.
And we have a choice of 12 different flavors, but I'm choosing this for you because it's the grittiest, okay? And I want to get that stain out. Bubblegum, pina colada, orange, tropical, good old-fashioned mint.
Inside an elegant brownstone on Manhattan's Upper East Side, businesswoman Jane Ubell lies back in a deep leather chair. She watches a TV that hangs above her head while dental hygienist Vicky Blaslov flosses and polishes her teeth. Ubell comes to the New York Center for Cosmetic Dentistry four times a year for what's known in the office as a floss and gloss.
It's always a treat when somebody else flosses you. I feel completely pampered when somebody else is doing this work.
The half-hour procedure is billed as a spa treatment, though it amounts to an extra cleaning. Ubel, whose mother endured years of painful gum disease, says it's worth every cent.
This is a necessity, I have to tell you. It's like any part of a healthy regime. Plaque and stress and gingivitis and all the periodontal disease. I need to make sure that I don't get that.
Ubel has also had her teeth bleached here. Dentist Jeff Golub-Evans directs the center. He thinks the public's passion for bleaching is mostly media-driven. But he adds Americans' desire for whiter teeth stretches back beyond the era of television or even movies. In 1888, he says, one Philadelphia dentist had a bright idea.
There was a dentist who figured out that if he took peroxide and put it on people's teeth and then heated it with a poker from a fireplace near your mouth, I admit this is unwieldy, that your teeth would turn white. And there were people who showed up at that dental office. So maybe, you know, maybe it's in Americans' genes because we have been whitening teeth in this country for 150 years.
Golub-Evans' pièce de résistance is decidedly less dangerous. He calls it a smile makeover where he transforms misshapen teeth using bonding material or veneers.
A good smile, like good eyeglasses, actually can maximize your positive features and minimize the negative features.
In the Chicago suburb of Northfield, dentist Jeff Butel proudly polishes a freshly made porcelain veneer.
The surface, we make sure that there's no little pits or irregularities in the surface.
Butel says strides in technology have brought the public big benefits, like the machine that designed and produced this custom-made veneer in 20 minutes. Cosmetic procedures are so advanced, he says, that nowadays a restored tooth can look entirely real. As for dental spas, he thinks they're a fad.
I'm a meat and potatoes type of dentist. I think a dental spa, to me, in some respects, is putting on airs.
He says he considered branching into spa territory, but concluded he was giving his patients excellent plain vanilla dentistry as it was. He says the public reads up on dental trends, and its growing familiarity with cosmetic procedures has forced dentists everywhere to snap to attention. But have they raised prices to capitalize on the demand?
If the dentists are busy and their schedules are full, they probably are less reluctant to raise their fees, so in that respect, I would say probably the fees have gone up some, but I don't think they've gone up disproportionately.
Butel revels in the brave new world of cosmetic dentistry.
It's a fun time to be a dentist.
If you ask Mike Roach, it's not a bad time to be a patient either. Roach is a regular at the New York Center for Cosmetic Dentistry. As a musician's tour manager, he spends a lot of time liaising between the artist he's working for and the club where they're performing. He'll gladly pay for treatments such as bleaching or a floss and gloss, he says, because appearances matter.
As with any job, people talk behind people's back, I suppose, and you get to hear things like, oh, did you see his teeth? They're not. If you don't take care of yourself, how can you take care of someone else?
Roach says his gleaming teeth are a testament to how seriously he takes his job. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
We've all heard the legendary tale about the president who could not tell a lie. You know, sort of like the current crop of White House hopefuls. Anyway, never tell a lie is a good rule to live by, when you can. But do you ever feel like sometimes you just have to, well, bend the truth a little? Commentator Lucy Kellaway does every day.
I am a liar. This statement doesn't sound pretty, but it's the truth. So far today, I've congratulated someone on their new job, even though I think it a complete mystery how they ever got promoted. I emailed various readers thanking them for their interesting points, which I actually thought were tedious. If you work in an organization, I bet my shirt that you're a liar too. We're all liars, but lies are necessary. The corporate world demands them. Indeed, it can't function without them. There are loads of reasons for this. Workplaces are hierarchies. That means we kiss up and kick down. Offices are competitive, which means you have to put your best foot forward and sell yourself, which usually means stretching the truth. The rules of office life also invite us all to cover up infringements, so we lie about taking days off, being late for work, or slacking. Unrealistic targets and budgets also make lying essential. In fact, lying about the work itself is necessary to keep us doing it. Thus, we claim to be passionate about what we do when in fact we barely tolerate it. Lies are so deeply woven into the fabric of office life that if you took them away, the whole thing would unravel. I know an ad man who's an alcoholic. Recently, he joined Alcoholics Anonymous and took a promise always to be truthful. When he returned to work, he took it upon himself to tell a client they were being overcharged. He instantly became far more dangerous as a truth teller than he had ever been as a drunk. It's a dangerous balance. The lies that we tell have to be believable, but somehow we must stop somewhere short of actually believing them ourselves. The most dangerous people in business are the ones who believe their own lies.
Lucy Kellaway is a management columnist for the Financial Times. Do you believe what you just heard? We'd like to know what you think. No lie. Again, just find the link that says contact at marketplace.org. Okay, time for the real truth now about the father of our country. Given that George Washington is one of the men we honor today, a quick history quiz seems appropriate. Was he a man who, A, chopped down a cherry tree but couldn't lie about it? B, had wooden teeth? Or C, was he one heck of a whiskey distiller? Hillary Wackay found the correct answer just down the Potomac from the nation's capital.
Near the end of his life, George Washington was the nation's largest producer of whiskey. In 1799, he distilled 11,000 gallons.
Everybody thinks they know something about George Washington. Frankly, most of what they know is wrong. You know, myths like the cherry tree and the wooden teeth, of course.
Dennis Pogue is the director of restoration at General Washington's home in Mount Vernon. Now visitors can see and smell a bit of accurate history brewing. Reenactors in continental dress pour boiling water over the rye, corn, and barley. They stir the sweet mash, then cook it in a copper still where the steamy alcohol is condensed and collected. And Pogue has a theory as to how this bit of economic history got separated from the George Washington we know.
Some of it was purposeful. And Washington actually was seized upon in the 19th century by folks, you know, in the temperance movement. They sort of rewrote history, and they maintained that Washington didn't drink and was, you know, opposed to alcohol.
Even Peter Cressy, the president of the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S., didn't know of Washington's whiskey making. But once he found out, Cressy and the distillers and wholesalers he represents quickly raised a couple of $1 million to help fund the archaeological digging and rebuilding of the distillery. And they put their own spin on Washington. He was no teetotaler.
He represents all the things that are great about American values, entrepreneurship, moderation, social responsibility. So it was a natural for us to do it.
At a recent ceremony opening the distillery, the actor playing Washington gave it the praise history now tells us the first president would have.
Well, my dear friends, raise your glasses in a toast on three huzzas for the whiskey. Huzzah! Huzzah! Huzzah!
In Mount Vernon, I'm Hillary Wackay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, a report out today shows media employment fell to a 15-year low in December. Ouch. Down to around 887,000. Around the same time, marketing and advertising jobs broke a record, rising to 769,000. Ad Age analyzed federal numbers to come up with that tally today. And, of course, we're always here to bring you the cold, hard facts, even if we might have to pout about it later. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets were closed today for the President's Day holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, two words you didn't expect to ever hear together.
Wound honey, wound honey, wound honey, wound honey, wound honey. Just think about Dr. Nordyke's wound honey.
I'm Bob Moon. Kai will have the buzz on that tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
American Public Media.
a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.